We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking some about the life and work of one of America's greatest writers, Mark Twain. And certainly this year, admirers of Mr. Twain have a lot to celebrate. In the fall, in November, people will mark the 175th anniversary of his birth. Also, a little earlier this year, Huck Finn turned 125. And in fact, this day, the 21st of April, marks the centennial of his death. Now, maybe that's not something to celebrate, but one of the things that we can certainly say is that even though he passed away 100 years ago today, Mark Twain is still very much still with us. He was, in his time, arguably the best-known American in many ways, the first modern celebrity, and I think it's probably true to say that of American writers, certainly of American writers of the 19th century, he is one of the most widely read. In this hour of the show, we have as our guest Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English here at the University of Illinois, has done a lot of writing about and thinking about Twain. He's the author of two books, Mark Twain on the Loose, A Comic Writer and the American Self, was published in 1995, and more recently, the book Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution, which was in large part about Twain's interest in the technology of printing and publishing. Bruce was here on the program back in January of 2008. We talked about that, and if you'd like to go back and hear that entire interview, you certainly may if you go to our website. And here this morning as we talk about Mark Twain, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And also we have the email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Hi, David. Fun to be here.
We appreciate it. I think that it's true to say that in his time, he was one of the best-known Americans on the planet. He was an international celebrity. And maybe in ways that we can talk about, he may have been the first or one of the first international celebrities. So if we just talk about Twain in his time, his popularity in his time, why was he such a loved revered figure?
This might sound like a heretical way to start, but he was a really, really good, persistent, brilliant self-promoter. I mean, an awful lot of the celebrity shtick that we have to live with now, he caught on to or cooked up quite early on. Even the positioning of his house when he made his first big bundle of money off of his travel books and put it together with his wife Olivia's fortune, and they decided to have a house in Hartford, which was where his publishing company was and a lot of business was going on. He picked the lot right across the hedge from Harriet Beecher Stowe's house. This is like going to Hollywood and getting the property next to Spielberg. And he put up the glitziest house that big new high-end subdivision had ever seen, right on the main streetcar line, so people would come by and say, oh, that's where Mark Twain lives. So even that way, he was good at it. We all know about the white suit, which he picked up in his last years. Mm-hmm. That was, in some ways, a strategic decision. He knew that photographs were easily represented in newspapers, and he knew he would look great against a dark background. It was a way of playing off against the look. That, postcards with his quotations on it, potboiler novels spun off of the Goodwins, plays that were also spun off of his successful novels. I mean, he constantly rolling the log.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the fact that he, and I'm sure we'll talk some more about his interest in media technologies. I was thinking about the fact that were he with us today, I'm sure that he would be pretty he'd have a Facebook page and he'd be tweeting.
Absolutely.
And I was thinking about the postcards with the one-liners on there. I'm thinking, well, that was sort of the tweets of the day.
For sure. Absolutely. He tried really, I said that in the last book, that he tried to be the Bill Gates of his time as well as a major writer. And he spent all that money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, creating what he thought was the ultimate typesetting machine. He went bust with that. He had his own publishing company. He tried to control, and he did control for about 20 years, every aspect of every book that he wrote, what it looked like, what the cover was like, what the paper was going to be, what the illustrations were going to be. And he had his finger in a new illustration technology, which also cost him money. he bet on electric motors and bet on the wrong motor. He went for direct current as opposed to alternating. He knew so much. He was like one of those insiders who always loses money on the stock market because he's overloaded with detail and can't step back. But definitely wanted to be in the mix of the media storm of his time.
Yeah. Now, and you can tell me, being a professor of English, whether this is true, but I am guessing that of the leading writers of the 19th century, now Twain is probably the most read. Now, that may be an overstatement. I don't know.
My guess is he is the one who is most read without the life support of colleges, universities, and English departments.
Okay.
Whether or not the Scarlet Letter, you know, is the number one literary diphtheria shot in the country, I don't know. We'd have to check the details on that. But almost everybody I've run into has had some kind of a brush with Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, yeah. Prince and the Pauper, Connecticut Yankee.
Well, and the others, I'm sure, Thoreau and Longfellow and Hawthorne and Dickinson and Melville, probably most people encounter them first in school, and it may be the only time they encounter them. So that's a forced exposure. Twain, though, seems to actually be one of those writers that still probably most people read Twain when they're kids.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be one of those writers that more people read as adults probably and willingly than these other major icons of American literature.
Yeah, he was smart in that he reached out in the 1870s to a new demographic. A whole new market was opening up. When the railroads spread across the country, forced into the Midwest and farther by the Civil War, and publishing went through big changes which made it faster and cheaper to put books out, Clemens realized that there were all these people in small towns that were not being reached by the Eastern publishers but could be reached if he got the books to Chicago and Kansas City and Cincinnati and Omaha and spread out, capillaried out from there. And that these were people who were intelligent, but who had very limited education, who were curious about the world, cut off from the world. So if you could bring the world to them in a language that they understood, in a voice that they would feel comfortable with, and could do that without compromising intellectually, you could really open up, and he succeeded in doing that. So I think a lot of people sort of grip on, this was the writer that my grandmother read and loved, and so there's a passing down through families that way.
Well, just, and again, to go back to some of the things that we talked about and you talk about in Printer's Devil, I think one of the facts on the ground at the time that made Twain so popular was that there was an explosive development in communications technology that really made it possible for mass media as we know it today to get started. And so that you didn't have to live in a big city to read a big city paper or to read a novel, and that was something that Twain really understood and used to his own advantage.
Yeah, he had his nose pressed against the glass when he was a kid. As a printer in Hannibal, Missouri, he was working on a Washington press. It's one of these hand-operated presses where a couple of guys really beating their brains out all day could put out 800 sheets in a day. That was going really hard at it. Down the river in St. Louis, they were taking delivery on powered presses that could do 7,000, 10,000, 15,000 sheets in an hour. So, I mean, there was this amazing quantum jump. Mm-hmm. And he ran for St. Louis as soon as he could and got into that. And began to recognize, I think, right there in a hands-on way, what had happened, that print was going to become cheap, fast, abundant. And also, a writer could, for the first time, make a lot of money. I mean, he was one of the first people to make big bucks as a writer in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody else had to have a day job.
Now, we've talked about his popularity in his time. He's still remarkably popular, and the people's awareness of him, I think, is very high. Where we talked last, I made this observation that if we went out on the street with photographs of great American writers, you know, we could show a picture of Walt Whitman. Nobody knows who Walt Whitman is.
Mm-hmm.
You show people a picture of Mark Twain, everybody knows who Mark Twain is.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that, again, has something to do with Twain's self-promotion and the creation of this character, Mark Twain, that Mr. Clemens created. But I'm not sure that really answers the question why it is that he remains very popular and much loved among Americans today, now 100 years after he passed.
There's two possible vectors to take on that. I mean, we do have the continuation of his success in creating that image the hair, the mustache, the white suit, the speaking tours. He was a very good stand-up comic. People loved to see him and actually hear him as well as read him. That legend has been continued down. There were movies about him in the 40s, people like Hal Holbrook starting from the late 1950s and still going today, bring him back again and again on the stage. Think about what's going on this week in terms of the continuation of the legend out beyond the writing. There's actually a seance today at the Mark Twain House in Hartford, if you happen to be catching
it. Seriously?
Yeah, if you're in Hartford, Connecticut, and you pay $60, which is half the price of a Broadway musical, you can be in the room tonight where I guess they'll darken the lights and play musical saw music and try to bring him back. I kind of hope they don't succeed. Hartford's got enough problems. Over in Hannibal, early this afternoon, so if you're in the middle of the state and you jump in the car now, you might make it. They're going to bury a time capsule at the Mark Twain House. I don't know what you put into a time capsule in Hannibal, Missouri in 2010 that you'd want to dig up in 100 years. Maybe menus from the local restaurants. I don't know, but they're doing that. There's a big gala at Cornell on Friday. For some reason, not today, but Friday, which is a problem at Cornell because that's also Shakespeare's birthday. So I imagine the Renaissance people have their noses out of joint, but they're going to do a big thing there because Twain, when he was living in Elmira, would occasionally go up to Cornell and go drinking with the students on the commons. And so on the basis of that, they're going to lay claim to him. There is that, but there's something else that might be going on, too. I was talking to Richard Powers last night. I had the privilege of chatting with him for a while. And he noticed that we have a lot of interest now in what he calls romantic neuroscience, which is stories like the stories Oliver Sacks tells about people who undergo some kind of change cognitively, mentally, or over the course of years. And we keep focusing again and again on Twain in his last years, when he was really past his prime as a writer. He was having a lot of financial and emotional difficulty. He was drinking too much. He was smoking too much. His health was failing. But we've told that story about those last years from 1900 to 1910 again and again. And there's a new biography out right now about it. And I started thinking last night, why? Well, we want to know about those transitions. We want to think about Mark Twain as somebody who was not merely with us for a while, but changed over and over again. Small town kid, unpromising, printer, riverboat pilot, Wild West reporter, stand-up comic, novelist, world traveler, sage, father, tragic hero. I mean, the variety of that has made Twain's life into a novel in its own right.
Well, that strikes me that is one of the things that makes him such a compelling character, is that he embodies so many great American archetypes. In one person's life, that's virtually the story of America.
Absolutely.
Right there.
Yeah. You want to talk about the expansion, the cosmopolitan dimension of America, the move from the small town to the metropolis, the conquering of the frontier, the insertion of America into the world. Twain is right there as a figure in that over and over again.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English here at University of Illinois. We're talking about Mark Twain. This is the 175th anniversary year of his birth. He was born on November 30th, and as we get closer and closer to that time, I'm sure people will be talking more and more about Twain. Certainly people are talking about him today. This was the day that he died 100 years ago. Also this year, Huck Finn turned 125. And I'm sure that in the months ahead, we'll talk some more about Twain. There will be a lot of books. We already, I think, back where we keep the books that come in over the transom, there are at least four new books that have come out in the past couple of months. I think that there will be more coming. And if you have questions, comments, you want to talk about Twain, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit earlier about how many people read Twain, but I think that it's also true is that the things of his that they read are small in number. Basically, they read the big novels. He wrote a lot of things in his lifetime that probably aren't as well read. And if all you read is Huckleberry Finn or Adventures of Tom Sawyer, or maybe some of those other things that people do read when they're kids, Prince and the Pauper, things like that, what is it that you're missing if you don't read a little bit more broadly in Twain?
Some things are probably a good idea to miss if you want to worship him rather than read him, in that because he was a complete American who wanted to be rich and famous as well as to do great stuff, he did write sequels, which we kind of wince at. If you want to think of Huckleberry Finn as a book where a young boy makes an enormous moral breakthrough with regard to the importance of just seeing people as individuals and getting away from race prejudice, it's a good idea to stop there and not read Tom Sawyer Abroad or Tom Sawyer Detective. Tom Sawyer Abroad was a, let's put it gently, adaptation from Jules Verne's 5 Weeks in a Balloon. It's told by Huck, and Jim is back to what he's like in the first chapters of Huckleberry Finn, not what he's like later on. Mm-hmm. Tom Sawyer Detective is a detective story, and Jim, once again, is reduced to a flat character. So when we teach Mark Twain, pay no attention to the books behind the curtain. There's that. As he warms up, and his moral fury seems to intensify in his later years as he sees with dread America moving into becoming a world power and drifting into the empire race that everybody else was on in the 1890s and beyond. You get the so-called pen warmed up in hell anti-imperialist essays and commentaries, which have a kind of an uncanny relevance right now as we try to sort out our own relationship to the world. I think people moving beyond Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer could take a look at those. They're in some really good editions that are available in almost any big box bookstore or online.
All right. We have a couple of callers here. We'd be happy to take questions, comments. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email well-talk@illinois.edu. And let's start out here with somebody in line number two. Hello.
Is that I?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that he was in the Anti-Imperialist League, because I think the late phase is overlooked. I heard an interview with the woman, the fellow that wrote the book about his relation with the social secretary and the dynamics of inside the family, and a lot of it was about what they would allow in the press, or to be pressed, as it were. And I heard about a piece that I'd never heard before, which is called The United States of Lynchdom.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a while back there were campaigns to not have Huckleberry Finn read. I forget exactly what decade that was, but...
There was a fight at Mark Twain Senior High School a few years ago in Fairfax, Virginia. People picked up on the irony of that.
It was widespread about whether, mm-hmm. The then Ebonics or something of the dialect and the characterization of the slave. But it seemed to me that if people knew his progression and that he actually wrote this thing that was, I don't know when it was actually published, years later.
Yeah, it came out around 1900.
But it wasn't printed then, was it?
I think that one actually did get printed. Yeah, he was putting pieces into Harper's Magazine and the Century Magazine, and they've been collected, but they were scattered out, not in the foreground the way that Huckleberry Finn was by that point.
Mm. Well, it just seems to me that now more than ever we need an anti-imperialist league, and it's good to go back to the decade. Or the century ago that someone took the risk, even though he was, obviously probably terribly conflicted about, having relations with all of these people that could help him be rich and the wealthy people in his life, and at the same time, actually, it went through the whole class, I guess, the Manifest Destiny and the idea of the American century of empire. So I just really think that. I bring it up, but I don't think a lot of people actually talk about Twain in this regard. So thanks
a lot. Yeah, sorting out his politics is very tricky, and a lot of biographies and a lot of critical studies try to do that. And it is a thicket. There are essays like The United States of Lynchdom. There's a piece called To a Person Sitting in Darkness, which is a profoundly, mordantly ironic story about how a combination of missionaries and military might are changing life, particularly in Asia and Africa. At other moments, he seems to back off on his moral fervor. His brother, Orion, got involved for a while in a kind of America First, close the door anti-immigration league, and was making speeches and doing writing about that. And Clemens never seemed to come out and try to shut that down or take a stand against it. So it's a bit of a hopscotch move through his politics to try to figure out what he abidingly thought as these issues came up.
And I think that it's true that while people would say that his attitudes towards race, or at least towards African Americans, were enlightened for his time, his attitudes toward Native Americans were not.
No, that's the so-called noble red man piece is really embarrassing. And when I do teach a Mark Twain course here, there's a week where we engage with stuff like that. And I tell the students, okay, grit your teeth. This is Sam Clemens, too. And if you want a complete sense of who he is, you've got to read this material. He was pretty ferociously anti-Native American in that. There are some really ugly sequences in Roughing It, where he talks about the Paiutes, a native group around in the country he was in Nevada. He was known at various points in his career to pander to the audience he was selling to. His satires on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Roughing It, well, they're just there. You know, they were an easy target. They were regarded as a fringe group, and he knew that if he was selling books in Iowa and Ohio and New Jersey, he didn't have to worry about that. Arthur Conan Doyle played that game, too, in the first great Sherlock Holmes story. He portrays the LDS as being this kind of fringe group. In other words, Twain is selling. He's involved in marketing as well as art, and that's just the mix which keeps people coming back to him again and again to try to sort him out.
Right. Another caller here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning to you all. I wanted to talk to you about Mr. Clements and Ulysses S. Grant. They seem to have an interesting relationship. And how much of Grant's work did Clements actually do? He helped produce the book. Am I right?
Yeah. Actually, the biggest moneymaker, the biggest bestseller that the Charles Webster Company, which was Twain's own publishing company, ever produced was the personal memoirs of U.S. Grant.
Yeah. Now, did Clements actually have a hand in it more than just being the publisher?
Actually, as far as we know, no. There is a holographed manuscript of the memoirs in Grant's handwriting. It's been alleged periodically over the decades that Clements copy edited it or ghost wrote it or something like that. But Grant, in one of the last great heroic sequences of his life, was dying of cancer of the throat. At a cabin up in upstate New York, a summer cabin, and he got that thing written and finished really just weeks before he died. And that book was a real bombshell. And there was a close relationship. It grew kind of obliquely. Clemens was briefly an estate militia loosely affiliated with a Confederate army in the opening days of the Civil War. By that point, Missouri was just still in the outback. No serious fighting was going on, so he spent 2 weeks with the Marion County Rangers, as they were calling themselves. Then he got out of there, and he got out of there because his brother had written Lincoln's campaign biography for the state of Missouri, and Lincoln had given him a patronage job out in Nevada. The farther west you went, the farther away you went from the Civil War and all the heat, so they both took a flyer out to there, which was kind of neutral territory, so he kind of sat out the war. The battle is today is whether or not Clemens should be regarded as a Southern writer, empathetic with the Confederacy in some ways. I don't see much to back that up. The relationship with Grant was a personal friendship. There were lots of speeches and encomiums that Clemens delivered about how wonderful Grant was as a leader, and it was an honor as well as a financial pleasure for Clemens to produce that book.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. I know that it's regarded as being one of the best written presidential memoirs. It was a huge bestseller. I suppose if you could sell a copy to every Union veteran,
it was almost a guaranteed sale. Yeah,
and it was very beneficial to Grant's family because, as you say, he was dying, and he knew that he was dying, mm-hmm. and he wanted to do something to provide for his family. And I think that Clemens wanted to help. Did he also, though, think that he was going to make a lot of money?
Oh, sure. And after that book sold so well, the Webster Company went out and tried to sign up every general officer in the Union Army. They did Sheridan's memoirs. They went for Custer, but Custer died before he got a chance to. So Custer's widow's memoirs are in there. Basically, anybody in blue who was like a divisional commander or an army commander got a contract from somebody. In a lot of cases, it was the Webster Company. They had to hustle through the 1980s. I mean, the 1880s, because a lot of these guys were dying off. Yeah. The again, if you figured you could sell to the guy's division, you could make a buck. Yeah. So there's a whole lot of these memoirs are down on the lower stacks of the university library.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English, has written a lot about Twain, has author of the books Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution, that published by the University of California Press, 2006. It's about Mr. Clemens' interest in printing and publishing technology. He's also author of the book Mark Twain on the Loose, A Comic Writer in the American Self, University of Massachusetts Press, 1995. We're talking about Mark Twain. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to take a minute, and maybe you might talk a little bit about an exhibit, and I think it's scheduled to open today at the U of I library.
Yeah, it's open now. The U of I's library is such a wonderful resource that they sometimes don't even know what they themselves have got. So I talked to Valerie Hotchkiss out there, who's the curator of rare books and special collections. She got together a handful of brilliant graduate students who went out on a kind of an Indiana Jones prowl through these archives. And they found all sorts of stuff we didn't know we had and some stuff that we hadn't really brought out to the light recently. There's a letter over there which is going to draw a lot of buzz. It's a handwritten letter from Twain to Howells from fairly late in that last decade. William Dean Howells was Mark Twain's close friend for 30 years. And this is a letter. It's a short one in which he takes a slam at Jane Austen. Now, when I was over there and people were reading it, I heard some gasping and I had to explain. I think it's a joke. I think that Twain knew how to needle his close friend Howells. He knew that Howells, as a great critic and a champion of a lot of diversity in modern letters, liked Jane Austen, worshipped Austen. So this is a way of just giving a friendly poke there. The letter says, "Like, I can't stand a reader. You know, she's no good." And actually, a few years ago, Twain's complete set of Jane Austen turned up. And Twain's annotations are all the way through. Mm-hmm. So he read his Austen here. And the admiration probably runs deeper than that letter would suggest. There's a bronze casting of his hand, the kind of thing that you associate with, you know, icons like Abraham Lincoln. There's some really interesting, quirky photographs that we have, including a picture of him in his famous octagonal gazebo study, which stood up in Elmira, New York. It's still there. It's been brought down to the college level. That was the place where we tried to do a seance last August, and we ended up with Hal Holbrook. That's another story. But
well, that's about as close as you're going to get. Okay. If you can get Hal Holbrook to turn up.
Yeah, he did. We had a quadrennial conference, and 4 days of Mark Twain every 4 years. And so we were exhausted. There was a big party up at so-called Quarry Farm, which is on a hillside outside of Elmira, which is where Clemens did most of his summer, most of his work, in this gazebo which the family had built for him because he was smoking, this is not a made-up number, 300 cigars a month. We have the orders. That's 10 a day, and we're not talking about little.
You'd have to have a cigar in your hand every waking moment.
Yeah, he said he controlled himself. He only smoked one cigar at a time, but he would literally buy them by the barrel, and so he was a living chimney, and because people in the family had lung problems, including his own wife, they built this place about 200 yards from the house where he could open the windows and smoke himself silly. And that's where he wrote Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, Connecticut Yankee, Prince and the Pauper, an awful lot of his work. So we know the gazebo study has been moved down to a safe place down at Elmira College, which does a lot of great stuff to preserve Twain's legacy. But up on this hilltop in the woods, there's a ring of stones where the gazebo stood. And every 4 years, when the Twain people get comfortable at the end of this thing, they light up cigars, stumble up in the woods, and blow smoke over this study in a kind of, you know, flip way of seeing whether we can bring him back. And by surprise, Hal Holbrook turned up at this conference and was at the party. So he came up the hill and eventually ended up with us standing in a circle with unsmoked cigars and Holbrook smoking his in the middle, telling Twain stories into the night, because he's really done his homework and he knew the daughter and he knew the granddaughter and knows an awful lot about the family. That was as close as we got to raising the dead.
Can you talk some more about the ways in which Sam Clemens, in a very deliberate way, constructed this character that then he came to play?
We got to remember one of the things he did to get himself going was stand-up comedy. And when the railroads webbed across the country, He hooked up with agents who booked him day after day all over the place. And apparently he was brilliant in being able to warm up an audience. He was in Champaign, Illinois on December 26, 1872. I had to look that up for the opening of this rare book thing. He played Paris, Illinois. I don't know where you could play in Paris, but there must be an old opera house downtown, which is probably being used for something else. He was there. Mm-hmm. He was in Tuscola. Basically, anywhere there was a water tank and a whistle stop, he got off and he did a talk, and he worked his way across the Midwest. Whenever he ran short on cash, he would do some of these tours. And when he really went broke, all-out bankruptcy in 1895-96, one of the ways he recovered, David, was to get himself on a world tour. By this point, he was a big enough rock star internationally that he could go to Australia, India, South Africa, and across Europe, taking months and playing to those audiences. He got a big book out of that, but that was one of the things which established him also as a worldwide celebrity. And I said, you know, the spinoffs and the synergy were great too. He created a character in a book which is now largely unread. It's called The Gilded Age, which was co-written by an author named Charles Dudley Warner, who was a good conventional novelist, and it was an attempt to make a buck by satirizing American capitalism. Here we go with the ironies again. Mm-hmm. There was a character named Colonel Sellers that came off of that, who became a kind of a shtick comic character, and so they did one Colonel Sellers play after another, which helped keep the revenue coming in. So, you know, visually, before he went to the white suits, he was wearing sealskin coats and outlandish ties. You know, he was really good for recognizing that the photo opportunity was coming and the crowds could be drawn. There's one more story about him taking a group of family and friends to the old Waldorf Astoria on a sloppy New York winter night and going in a side entrance where the cab had left them off, and nobody paid any attention to them. Clemens apparently threw a mild hissy fit and got the whole group to walk all the way around the Waldorf, which was a huge hotel, to go in the main door so everybody would say, oh, there's Mark Twain. He would also time his carriage rides in an open carriage to go down Park Avenue just when the churches were letting out. It's kind of like Lady Gaga finding her way, you know, in the Covent Garden, you know, at just the right moment before a concert. He was very good at that.
Let's talk with some other callers. Toll-free line 4. Hello. Is a caller there, line 4?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'd like to make a comment on one of Twain's books that I read back many years ago now, Letters from the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to hear your guest comment on what time of his life did he come up with that book, and any comments you have on it. No, I'll listen off air. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Let me swing up on that a little bit sideways. There's a new edition of the autobiography coming out starting in November. This thing is going to be huge. It's a project that's gone on literally for decades at the Mark Twain Papers at the University of California at Berkeley. The first volume, it's going to be 3, is 750 pages long, and that doesn't include the zillion footnotes, which they're going to upload onto a website. In that autobiography, there's some new material that Twain had said he didn't want to have published for 100 years. The stuff that's popped up as teasers hasn't been all that surprising yet, but there's a comment in there that was taken out of the first people to do much compressed autobiographies of Twain about having an abiding on-and-off affection for Satan. And it was a crack that he liked to make on his stand-up tours that, you know, after all, the spiritual leader of two-thirds of the human race and the political leader of all of it must be a man with some, you know, with some special skills. I think he looked at Satan as being a way of describing human nature as it really is, human weakness as it really is. It's not Milton's Satan. It's not the insurrection against God. It's more the grump in the corner, and the way of saying things which were playfully irreverent, which you really couldn't say on the main street or in church. There's a famous crack he made about Chicago that's in Pudd'nhead Wilson's calendar, if I can get it right, doing this from memory, Satan impatiently to a new visitor to hell. The problem with you Chicago people is you think you're the best people down here, whereas you are merely the most numerous. So this is around 1895. So at the turn of the century, Chicago was already coming into its own.
All right. Let's go to another caller here on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. This is from the Myths of Memory from another talk show program a long time ago. At the end of his life, did Twain have a group of little girls that he wrote to? They were called his angels. Is my memory complete?
Yeah, they were the angelfish. And,
okay. Thank you.
You're right, absolutely right. And actually, if you can find on eBay or in a rummage sale in Connecticut, one of the little gold angelfish pins which he issued to this collection of little girls, you probably got something that should be on Antiques Roadshow. He had at that point in his life, the daughter that he was closest to, Susie, was dead suddenly of spinal meningitis. His wife, Olivia, was gone. He had moved to a new house designed by William Dean Howells' son in Connecticut. He was struggling with congestive heart failure. His health was going. He had an entourage around him, which was kind of trying to provide connection to the world and trying to prop him up and help him through the rough patches. And this was a collection of neighborhood girls that he just seemed to invite over to the house to sort of play there, because having raised daughters and having lost, he lost Susie, and Jean had all sorts of health and neurological problems. That was the second daughter. And the relationship with Clara, the other daughter, was strained. These girls, I think, filled an emotional void in his life. Continued for a couple of years there.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I thought I remembered that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. About 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Our guest is Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and has written a lot about Mark Twain, including his books Mark Twain on the Loose and Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution. It's a big year for Twain fans. Coming up November 30th, his 175th birthday. Also this year, Huckleberry Finn turned 125, and on this day 100 years ago, Mr. Clemens passed away, but as I said at the beginning, he's still very, very much with us, and I'm sure in the months to come, as we get closer and closer to his birthday, there'll be a lot more talk about Twain and popular media, something which I'm sure he would have appreciated and wanted to have a piece of, no doubt. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. How did he feel about copyright issues and piracy? That was something that he had to contend with.
Yeah, again, we have wonderful contradictions in that. One of the reasons that America finally stopped being not the pirate of the Caribbean, but the pirate of the North Atlantic, shamelessly ripping off European, particularly British publications, was that Twain was getting ripped off in return. And he went to Congress in the 1880s and 1890s howling, with moral indignation that he was being handled in this way in England, Scotland, and Canada. One of the things that made piracy easy, even easier than it had been when we were stealing people like Dickens and Scott, was the invention of electrotype, which allowed you to make a very quick, absolutely perfect, durable, flexible, easily transportable copy of a set page of type. And if you were in a factory someplace making these for a publisher legitimately, there was no reason why at night you couldn't make a few more, sell them to a guy from Toronto, and sure enough, bang, 2 weeks before Tom Sawyer was released in the United States, pirate editions began to appear in Canada. It made the stealing a lot easier. This was kind of maybe in some ways the distant ancestor of the online, rip-offs that go on constantly now. So we signed the so-called Chase Act in 1893 to finally join the rest of the world in a kind of a civilized international copyright law. But there are moments when Twain himself borrows, in quotation marks, from other writers extensively in order to pad out his own works. And if you go deep into the papers, you'll find these legal fights and these heated exchanges back and forth in writing between Twain or people in his company against people who are claiming with some legitimacy that this or that had been stolen.
Yeah. One of his first jobs, maybe it was his first job, was working in a print shop,
mm-hmm.
and it was his brother's shop. His brother had a little newspaper there in Hannibal. So Twain was very early on introduced to printing technology, got a chance to see his own writing in print, which I'm sure was pretty heady. And then as we talked, Twain comes when everything seems to come together. We have better powered presses moving away from handset type, and that makes it easier to print a lot of copies of a paper or a book. It also meant the beginnings of piracy. We have the coming of the telegraph. We have the beginnings of international mass media. All that comes together as Twain is coming of age. So are there some ways in which that really either shapes his writing, or you can actually see in his writing the fact that it's the dawn of mass media?
Yeah, I think one crucial moment is when Orion, that's his older brother, who owned this half-starved newspaper in Hannibal that his kid brother, Sam, was working for nothing at. Orion set things going by leaving town frequently and leaving his 16-year-old brother completely in charge of this newspaper. Okay, the town had no telegraph service. All the news that was getting there secondhand, mostly by steamboat. And pretty early, this extravagant, playful, mischievous kid had control of a newspaper. He could put stuff in there that he was transcribing from the St. Louis Press or other presses. He could also make stuff up. And when he goes out to Virginia City, Nevada, again, you're out there in the middle of nowhere. There's one major newspaper in town. He's working for it. Everybody is believing what they're reading. And so this begins to set off the practical jokes. His first nationally picked up piece was an anonymous piece, which was published as a news report. It was about a petrified man being found out in the desert. And you have to read down to the third paragraph of that to see that the position of the man has him thumbing his nose at you, you know. But apparently dozens of papers picked this up as a report of a real-life petrified man, and it spread around. It wasn't for several days that people realized they were being jerked around. Just the excitement, the euphoria, the headiness of being able to just print stuff which was straight from the jug and momentarily at least throw things off balance is something he never lets go of.
Yeah. Well, a little bit earlier, you talked about the fact that within Twain studies, there is some argument about to what extent or whether he was a Southern writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that there are other people who would say, well, really what he is a Western writer. And that experience very much shapes his character and where he's coming from.
Yeah. Actually, somebody tried to solve this problem a few years ago by actually taking a ruler on a map of the United States and drawing from the Mason-Dixon line straight west and demonstrating without a shadow of a doubt that Hannibal, Missouri is north of the Mason-Dixon line. Whether Clemens himself ever realized that or whether that makes any difference, I don't really know. There was some pieces that were written recently about Twain's first encounter with big cities. And he goes to St. Louis first, and then he's over in Cincinnati, and then but he's making regular jumps down to New Orleans. That's his route as a riverboat pilot. And if you read the commentaries he writes about the Deep South in Life on the Mississippi, where an awful lot of that stuff occurs, and in some of his letters, there's always a kind of a distance from it. I mean, if he becomes a cosmopolitan figure, he's cosmopolitan in that sense that he's always kind of looking at things from a kind of remove. There's never any real writing about any Southern city that really shows a complete identification or affection. As Huck and Jim move farther south, that world seems to grow stranger and more hostile, you know, as they get deeper into that country. And the fact of the matter is, after he did that tour in the early 1880s to do the research and get the new material for Life on the Mississippi, he never went to the South again. He never lectured in Atlanta or Mobile or New Orleans or any place like that. He stayed mostly in the East and the Midwest.
And is there any clues about why that was, or anything that would have said really what he truly felt about the South or about Southerners?
I think it was cultural. I mean, places like Hannibal and St. Louis were strange in the era of race slavery in the United States. Hannibal, Missouri had about 3,000 people and about 2,000 slaves, according to a recent study that was done. And slaves were sometimes rented out. It turns out that Twain's father had bought and sold slaves or had gotten them as collateral in various legal dealings. They were part of that world. St. Louis was even stranger. There were hundreds of freemen, free African Americans living in the same burgeoning metropolis as hundreds and hundreds of slaves that were still in servitude, blacks that were still in servitude. So, I mean, this was a kind of a weird, eerie, vertiginous world, different, really very different from the Cotton South. You know, where the life was, the agricultural substrate was different. The cultural relationship between white and black might have been incrementally different, too, than what it was, say, in Louisiana or Alabama around that time. Yeah.
We have maybe 5-6 minutes left this morning in this part of Focus. If you'd like to call in and ask questions, make comments, Bruce Michelson is our guest. He's professor of English at University of Illinois. We're talking about Mark Twain. I want to mention, too, by the way, that we're having some computer problems here this morning at WILL, so we will not be able to bring you the usual market update that we do at 10:59, and we hope as soon as we can get those things taken care of, and we'll get back to our regular update. So we'll go right to the news at 11:01, and then there'll be another hour of Focus. So hope that you will stay with us. You know, if people have not read Twain since, say, they were in maybe in grade school or high school, so their last Twain might have been Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer or some of those things, Prince and the Pauper, things that are actually thought of as children's books. So if they've really have not had adult exposure to Twain, what do you think that people might get out of going back as adults and reading those books that maybe they haven't read since they were kids?
I think a good place to start to sort of reacquire your taste and decide which Mark Twain you like, there's a couple of really good collections of his sketches, the short stuff, and excerpts of the funniest or most ambitious passages from an awful lot of those books. There's a two-volume Library of America series, which you could take a look at. But you can read around. You can watch him over the course of decades change his voice, change his ambitions, alter his sense of the audience that he's writing to, writing from a broader and broader background of worldly experience and literary experience. Those are fun. And, you know, considering, gosh, how beleaguered we are and how short the spurts are that we have to read what we want on our own, this would be a good thing to take on a long plane flight. And you could read around in it, and you'd know that there'd be enough variety in there that to keep you amused. I also like, you know, I like The Innocents Abroad. I think that's an undervalued book. That was, Twain got lucky there. He was sent as a correspondent on the first big American tourist raid on Europe, the first time that a ship had gone over with hundreds of people strictly for tourism. And nobody had done that before. There were people who had money after the Civil War. Steamships were faster and more reliable. He got on that, and he wrote from the point of view of an ordinary American seeing things for the first time, and how he enacts that first experience for us, the first time you land in Paris and look up at, well, the Eiffel Tower wasn't there, but you look at the place that is storied as part of your imagination, but not encountered firsthand. Those are really fun encounters.
Yeah, and we think of him because of the big novels, but it was really that book that was his first big success.
He always made more money off the travel books than he did off the fiction. There were an awful lot of people in this country who felt they were never going to be able to get anywhere. Right now, everybody expects to haul out the passport, and if the volcano shut down, being somewhere else in the world, you know, next week. Yeah. But Europe and Asia were far, far away. So these books were not only vicarious adventure. The way they were set up, they were also home decoration. They were loaded with illustrations, and a lot of these pictures in the Twain travel books were tipped in, meaning there was nothing on the back of the page. So, you know, if the farm wife saw a really nice picture of the Acropolis or the Vatican at night or something, she could snip that out and put it on the side of the sod house. It was really for that purpose.
Yeah. We have an email here. Someone wrote in and apparently who's been to Hannibal and says when you go there, it seems to be a pretty rustic place. The listener was wondering, did Twain have people mentoring him there, or was he just an extreme outlier?
Clemens says that in Hannibal, when he was a boy, he says everybody was poor and didn't know it. So he's born there in 1835. The town is founded around 1820. So it's just barely got its fingernails into the Mississippi mud along there. It's located where it is because it's kind of at a low point in the river, and steamboat docks could be built easily and boats could pull in. So With all due respect to Hannibal, it's not exactly the most picturesque of the Mississippi River locations. There are much prettier bluffs up in Wisconsin. And if you go down to Louisiana, Missouri, there's a much more attractive area. It survived off the river when steamboat traffic began to erode at the end of the 19th century. It had to struggle for survival. There was a cement mill there in the 20th century, which was off-putting enough and destructive enough that kind of drove people out. And another thing that happened was old U.S. 36 sliced right through Hannibal, cutting off Cardiff Hill, which was the Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn site, from the rest of the town. So you had this four-lane highway slamming through. Great thing that's happened just in the last few years is U.S. 36 has been replaced by Interstate 72. And that swings around a mile north of the town now. So the city's been able to web together the hill, the old Mark Twain historic area, the downtown, so you can walk it much more pleasantly. It's much prettier. If you haven't been over to Hannibal lately, it's worth a trip. And the Mark Twain Museum has expanded down on Main Street. It's gotten much more attractive. It's certainly worth a stop.
Yeah. We'll try and get one more caller in here in the time that is left here on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mark Twain, wonderful man. He seemed to be everywhere at the same time. It's just amazing when you read his stuff. But I was going to say, his Travels Abroad books remind me of Melville's stuff of the South Pacific. But also want to ask you about the United States of Lynchardom. I'm looking online now.
Mm-hmm.
The University of Virginia has a copy of it. In the prologue to it, it says that, quote, Mark Twain said he didn't want it published because, quote, I shouldn't have even half a friend left down there in the South after it issued from the press. So I presume that he still had a lot of friends down there, but he didn't go there?
Well, I mean, he wanted to maintain a national reputation. I might be wrong about exactly when it came out. I said about 20 minutes ago. I thought it came out in his lifetime, but I have to go back and check that out.
It says here that it was published 13 years after he died.
After his death. His literary executors, back in those days, fidelity to text, something that we're so concerned about as scholastics now, really didn't matter too much. And so there was a lot of jockeying around of what Twain had written, including some outright literary fraud that was committed in order to present what Albert Payne, his number one executor, thought was the best Mark Twain to put forward. Most famous example of that was The Mysterious Stranger, where Payne went into the manuscripts, found three different, very different versions of the story, and an ending to the last version. He didn't like the one that Twain had finished, so he took the ending and glued it onto the first version that Twain had abandoned and wrote with a guy at Harper's four transitional pages themselves, channeling Mark Twain.
Oh.
And they put that out as The Mysterious Stranger as a Christmas story in 1916, and that was the one we had for 50 years until finally somebody went back and said, hey, somebody messed around with this.
One other question. Darwin's book, Origin of Species, was published in 1859.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see Clemens or Twain as a post-Darwinist atheist. Would you agree with that?
Ouch. I'd be a little bit more cautious with it. Twain, I sort of explained to myself as a person who didn't seem to have any antibodies to whatever new scientific finding or formulation hit. I think he was prostrated by Darwinism and some of its dubious permutations, eugenics, social Darwinism, all the biological and astronomical findings of the late 1870s. Late 1890s. He seemed to be paying attention to. And there's one letter after another, or journal entry after another, where he just seems like he's knocked to the floor by the transformation of the universe, human history, the idea of human size and worth. So, yeah, I mean, he's got the Darwinist disease. Whether he knows how to deal with it or get dominion over it imaginatively, that's where some of the trouble is.
We're going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest for this hour, Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English here at University of Illinois. One book you might want to look at if you're interested in Twain is his book, Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution, about Twain's interest in printing and publishing technology. And I'm sure that in the months ahead, we'll have some other opportunities to talk about Twain as well as we move toward the 175th anniversary of his birth. That'll be on November 30th. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David.
We appreciate it.